Welcome to the Natural Selection Presents Marsupials. Welcome back, listeners, to the Natural Selection Presents. We are here for another episode, this week all about marsupials. But first, we were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, we have Nick.
Hello.
We have Naomi.
Hello.
And I am Other Nick. Hello. Naomi, do you want to tell the listeners who we are?
Yeah, so we are the Natural Selection Presents. We are taxonomists, and we want to bring our passion for nature into the wild. Each episode, we meet up and we talk about the natural world. In the first section, we discuss nature news and some interesting research that we found over the last couple of weeks. In the second section, we discuss a different theme and we talk about how that relates to plants and animals around the world. This week's theme is marsupials.
Awesome. Thank you, Naomi. So, I should start by asking, have either of you had any interesting nature interactions out in the wide world?
I saw a man today who was being followed by pigeons. Yeah, a person, a human. He was being followed by pigeons. So one kept landing on his head, and then he'd take it off, put it on his hand, and then take it out. And there was pigeons all around him. And we were wondering. We kind of assumed that he had instigated this, but we were maybe he just these pigeons just love him, and he did nothing to encourage these pigeons, but he doesn't want to shoo them away. So he just has to deal with these pigeons for his entire day.
To the point where you said he had to take it off his head.
Yeah, so the pigeon, so basically, I don't know if it was the same pigeon or a different pigeon, but a pigeon would keep popping up into his head, and then he'd, take his hand, hold on to the pigeon would be on his hand for a couple of seconds, and then he'd sort of kind of casually shake off the pigeon again, and then it would, re-loop. And then also pigeons were on his shoulders as well, and he would, re-loop with his pigeon cycle as he just walked down the middle of Hyde Park.
Bizarre.
Yeah. Normally, it was very, it was weird.
I saw a bird this week somewhere where normally isn't, or at least where I don't normally see these birds. I saw a heron in a tree. It was just standing up in a tree, and I sort of thought, that's odd. And it was looking down at the water. And normally you see herons at the edge of the water standing around, walking slow death, waiting to stab something. And this one was in the tree. And then it suddenly leaped out of the tree, flew down to the water, and then flew away with a fish in its mouth. It was hunting from afar. It's pretty cool.
That is cool. I never spot fish from that far away.
Me neither. I don't know how you could do it. There's so much glare on the water.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think you can even spot fish standing directly above them in the water.
Yeah.
I've been locked in a room all week. I did see the silhouette of a bird, which I think is a swallow. Would they be here?
Yeah, they've been out lately too.
Yeah, I think I saw some swallows. They're the ones that look really defined in silhouette.
Mm-hmm. They look like high-tech boomerangs.
Yes, then it was a swallow. Mm-hmm. I'm not a bird person.
Me neither. We're mammal people. Both of us. Mammals.
Yeah.
Definitely lizard people.
No.
I was just about to say, yes, fellow mammal people, I am not a lizard person.
Well, on that note, I think we should get on with the news. I wanted to start us off this week with something that our audience may be tempted to do, which is yawn. And there might be more of a reason for that than we think. Because there's a study here released by researchers from Utrecht and Vienna, and it was released in Nature, and it was called Brain Size and Neural Numbers Drive Differences in Yawn Duration Across Mammals and Birds. And what they found is there was a strong correlation between brain size, number of neurons, and duration of yawning. And I knew one of us would start yawning as soon as I mentioned yawning. The first one to go is Naomi. So it may just be she has the biggest brain. Because that's the correlation they found. So yeah, the more neurons you have, the larger brain, the longer your yawns. And they believe this is evidence that yawning originally evolved as a method of cooling the brain. So it's a thermoregulation of the brain. So obviously birds and mammals are both warm-blooded creatures. And they found that this correlation held true, that as bird brains got bigger, their yawns would also get longer. And as mammal brains got bigger and there were more neurons, that this was also true. And they did this for 1,292 yawns across 101 different species were analyzed for duration, which is amazing. And what they found, weirdly, is that even though mammals, on average, if they had a similar brain size and neuron number as birds, they would still yawn longer.
Hmm.
But the correlation held true for both groups. But yeah, so if you're yawning away at home, it's not because we're boring. It's because you're very smart.
Or because your brain is very hot.
Cool. So that was my research. Now, Nick, you found some researchers who may just be animal botherers.
That's true. Nick, like you said earlier, some people may just have an animal that comes to them. And for some, it might be the tardigrade even, which I can assure you that it is not these researchers. So this was a study published in a journal called Astrobiology, which gives you a little hint as to what it might be about, by two researchers, a PhD student and her supervisor, who clearly were having some fun. They were curious about the possibility of two things. One, humans accidentally spreading life from Earth to other places that we send probes, and in some cases actually not accidentally, but recently a probe was sent to the moon with some tardigrades included on it in secret, which caused a big uproar. It was pretty, there was some news about it, I think, a couple years ago. And they were curious, one, if those tardigrades could survive the landing on the moon, and two, if other animals similar to something like tardigrades, which are super hardy, could survive crash landing from an asteroid onto Earth and maybe be the sort of origin point of life on Earth. So to test this, they did the obvious thing, which was to launch tardigrades out of a high-speed gun, which they first, so what they did to set up...
Can I just ask for, are these American researchers?
Of course. Yeah obviously. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they fed tardigrades moss and mineral water, which to me sounds like a nasty diet, but those water bears really love it. So then they flash freeze them to bring their metabolic rate down to the like freeze dried. You know, you hear about tardigrades surviving in the vacuum of space. This is how they do it. They like freeze themselves down and slow their metabolic rate to 0.1% of its normal pace. So they can survive pretty much anything when they're in that stage. So they brought them into that hibernation stage and then put them inside bullets in a special gun that's designed to shoot like super fast, way faster than a normal gun. And then some sort of like air gas gun. I don't really understand how that works, but that's not the point of this podcast. So
an air gun?
It's not an air gun. It's a gas gun, a light gas gun, it was called. And I don't know what that means, but it shoots things way faster than normal guns. And they basically took 20 tardigrades and shot them at different speeds to see, and then checked the bullets where they had landed to see if they survived with the tardigrades inside the bullets. And shockingly, not all of the tardigrades survived. The threshold was about 1.14 GPA, and I didn't know what the GPA was, so I had to look it up. It's about 0.9 kilometers per second.
Jesus
Christ. Was the speed of impact that a tardigrade could survive. And above that, they were, quote, mostly mush. So the tardigrades below that actually did survive, which is pretty astounding. But unfortunately, most asteroid impacts are faster than that. So it seems like, at first glance, the tardigrades can't survive the asteroid impact. But it's possible that some parts of the asteroid move at slower speeds or are protected from the main force of the impact and could survive. So basically, in the end, it doesn't seem likely, but it's possible.
That's funny, because that feels like one of those pieces of research that's answering a very important question, but doing it in quite a comical way. It's like, it's just like, shoot these tardigrades out of guns. Yeah, it's just, I like it.
But even if they, you know, broke their mouths, it's not the end of the world, because it appears that some animals could keep living.
So, yeah, this was a a research that I found that on the face of it seemed very funny, but then actually as I was reading it, it was kind of serious. So this piece of work was published in Clinical and Translational Resource and Technology Insights. It was produced by researchers mostly from Japan and one researcher from the US. And so what they were looking at, so they were actually inspired by the coronavirus pandemic and kind of some of the ways that the clinical need for ventilators, there was a huge demand for ventilators and artificial lungs, and this kind of caused a critical shortage. So inspired by that, they kind of looked at some ways in nature that animals, particularly aquatic organisms, have evolved to deal with low oxygen environments. So in particular, some aquatic organisms, particularly the loach, can have evolved intestinal breathing to be able to survive anoxic conditions. So they can use organs other than their lungs or their gills. So what they did in this research was they actually found that they provided evidence that a couple of mammal models, so they found it in rats, mice, and pigs, are able to do intestinal breathing, which is very interesting. So firstly, what they did is they made a intestinal gas ventilation system, and they administered pure oxygen through the rectum of mice. And in that system, yeah, they found that no mice survived 11 minutes of extremely low oxygen conditions. But with this gas ventilation, more oxygen was able to get to the heart, and 75% of mice survived 50 minutes of normally lethal low oxygen conditions. So obviously, this sort of technique wouldn't necessarily be viable in a clinical setting because it would involve kind of a invasive method, particularly for critically ill patients. So what they did was then they looked at another way of providing it. And what they did was providing a liquid form of oxygen, which is known as coagulated perfluorocarbon. And this has been like historically used in clinics for liquid ventilation. So it's proven to be safe and proven to be kind of effective. So they tested this instead. And my understanding is basically they like the animals were in kind of the liquid and then it was able to get into the intestines. So using this ventilation system, it provided therapeutic benefits in the rodents and pigs exposed to kind of non-lethal low oxygen conditions. So they found that mice that received this were able to walk further in kind of a 10% oxygen chamber and also more oxygen reached their heart. They also found similar results in pigs. So with these kind of results taken together, they find that this actually could be an effective strategy in clinical work, and this may be something that they could actually give to patients in order to improve their chances of survival in these kind of low oxygen situations when they're struggling on respiration and stuff, particularly in this kind of coronavirus setting when there's low the equipment isn't available. This is kind of maybe an alternative. But yeah, it kind of started out as something funny where it was like, oh, breathing through intestines. And then it got kind of serious.
Great.
So to conclude, pigs can breathe through their intestines.
Yep, that's pretty much it. And mice and rats.
Well, that is actually pretty cool news.
Yeah, or at least it like gives them enough oxygen to survive better than they would without it.
So if you're
not like, you know, it's not better than your lungs, but it'll do it at a pinch. So
in a sealed enclosure, running out of oxygen, and the only oxygen that you have access to, you can only administer by pumping it into your rectum, it might work for a while.
I just worry that that's how they'll tell them my mum how they found me.
Yes,
they will. And I don't think enough paramedics will have heard this study.
They will. That is what would happen.
So,
he put the oxygen.
He was in a low oxygen environment and he had an oxygen tank.
Yes.
But instead of breathing it, he put it up his bum. And we don't know why.
I feel like I need some sort of disclaimer now.
Don't try this at home.
Yeah.
In fact, don't try any of the things that we talked about today at home except yawning. Yawning is okay, but not right now. Not right now. We're having a podcast and you're learning a lot.
Well, I tell you what, now might be the perfect time because it's time for a short break before we come back with our theme, which this week is marsupials. So get that oxygen into your brain, cool it down, and join us after this short break. So welcome back, listeners. We are back this week to talk about marsupials, which are a type of mammal oft forgotten, especially by mammal researchers, of which we have two. And we're going to start with one of them on the surprising origins of marsupials.
Yeah, so before I get into kind of where marsupials originated, I wanted to talk a little bit about where you might find marsupials now. About 70%, so there's about 334 living species of marsupials, and about 70% of them are found on the Australian continent, so Australia and kind of the surrounding islands. The remaining 30% are found in the Americas, so mostly South America, some in Central America, and there's one in North America. If I was to get you guys to guess, based on what I've just said, where you think marsupials originate, what would you say?
I mean, the obvious answer based on the data we have is Australia.
Yeah, it's actually North America. Marsupials were around about 70 million years before they actually got to Australia. So you might think that Australia would be the obvious place, but it is actually not where they originated. So the oldest known marsupial is from North America about 125 million years ago from the Cretaceous period. So these ancient marsupials did quite well in North America. At the time, North America was part of a supercontinent, so the configuration of the land masses was a little bit different. So it's part of a supercontinent called Laurasia, and there's about 15 to 20 different.
It's more of an all right continent, or
let's be real, a pretty mediocre continent, at least the northern part.
Yeah, Canada.
Yeah, suck it. Hey.
So there's about 15 to 20 different species found here, and they did quite well, particularly after the non-avian dinosaurs went extinct about 66 million years ago. The marsupials were doing quite well here. And so then, at the time, North America and South America weren't connected. And this is something that Nick has actually gone into a little bit before on a previous episode, and he's kind of discussed some of the biases we actually have about kind of this understanding between this interchange. So I won't go into it too much here. But the marsupials went to South America. There they had a field day. The marsupials were very successful, and they diversified in about 2 million to 3 million years. So there was lots of different types of marsupials, lots of different forms. In another episode, we've talked about kind of the saber-toothed marsupials that have been found there. And even now, South America is still a marsupial hotspot. There's about 100 species of opossum, which I think we may be hearing a little bit more about. And actually, interestingly enough, the one species of marsupial that's left in North America actually traveled up from South America about a million years ago, and that's the Virginia opossum. So that's the only marsupial that's living north of Mexico. So marsupials arrived into Australia maybe about 50 million years ago. So I was finding a couple of different dates on this. So they actually arrived to Australia via Antarctica. So South America, Antarctica, and Australia were connected. They were part of a separate landmass, Gondwana. And so they seem to think that the marsupials arrived to Australia about 50 million years ago, probably shortly after Australia actually had split off. Because of this, they think that it suggests a single dispersion event of just one species. So it's most likely a South American marsupial. They think it's related to Monito del Monte, which its Spanish name means little monkey of the mountain, which I thought was really fun. And there's also fossil evidence. So the fossil marsupials that are found in Antarctica are quite similar to this species. At the time as well, Antarctica actually wasn't covered in ice. It was kind of a temperate forest. So, you know, it would have been kind of an okay place to transition through. There's also DNA evidence as well that this is kind of the ancestor of Australian marsupials. So that is how Australia got its marsupials, from this one species. And then it diversified pretty amazingly. There's, you know, upwards of 200 species of marsupial, or there was, and there was even more. So I thought that was kind of a cool origin of marsupials and how, where they came from and how they got to Australia.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, of all the places you think of marsupials, you don't necessarily think of Antarctica.
No. And funnily enough, actually, that you mentioned that, because there are other fossils of other kinds of mammals that are found in Antarctica, but they never seem to make it to Australia. So this kind of speciation event, or this kind of colonization event, seems like it was quite impressive, because, you know, there's fossils of ungulates and other kinds of mammals that just didn't get as far as Australia.
Is it true, Naomi, that there are no European marsupials today?
No, there aren't any. Yeah. They're only found in the Americas and Australia, or and surrounding islands.
A nice insight there on where marsupials have come from. But where are they now?
Great question, Nick. And in order to answer that question, I think in my research, the thing that stood out to me most was how little I knew about marsupial diversity in the present, which really astounded me. And a little bit of a bias alert, I guess placental mammals have a lot of our attention. And not only because they're sort of the majority of mammal species living today are placental mammals, but also because, like we just discovered, there were no marsupials living in Europe. And natural history is a epistemological framework that was developed in the West, and for that reason, I think, sort of ignores things that are present in the natural world, not in Europe until recently. So anyway, that's sort of the intro. But really what I want to talk about is the biodiversity of marsupials, and in particular, the fact that marsupial orders, the group of them, there's sort of two main splits and four main groups of these marsupials living today. They have similar morphological, genetic, and ecological diversity as the placental orders do. In order to sort of go through the breadth of the marsupial, I went through basically the whole marsupial tree and pulled things out, and I want to talk a little bit about it. So the main split is into two groups, the New World and the Old World groups. There's the Ameridelphia of the north of the Americas and the Australidelphia of mainly Australia and the sort of surrounding areas in Asia and throughout the South Pacific. In the Ameridelphia, it's the smaller group, and they're mostly made up of opossums, which I'll talk about later in much more detail. But there's somewhere between 75 and 100 species of opossums, and most of them live in trees and are omnivorous. There's also the herbivorous woolly opossum and the otter-like yapok. There are small terrestrial shrew-like forms, and the one that you mentioned, Naomi, which I totally fell in love with, the monito del monte, the tiny mouse-like opossum that lives in the forests of Chile and Argentina. Now, that's the sort of the Americas group. But the diversity in the Australidelphia is much more intense. So they've got marsupial cats and marsupial mice. They could have their own marsupial Tom and Jerry. The mice, actually, though, should better be called marsupial shrews, because they're carnivorous and insectivorous, not omnivorous like mice are.
Why aren't they called marsupial?
Okay, we'll call them marsupials. Happy to do that. Happy to make that change. Then we've got dog-like forms, which today are only known from Tasmania. The Tasmanian devil is the only living dog-like form. And the Tasmanian tiger, or the thylacine, is the sort of marsupial wolf that we'll talk about in a bit. I think Nick will talk more about that, which has been extinct since 1936, actually. Then there's a marsupial anteater called a numbat. Already we've covered a huge breadth of the placental tree in analogs in the marsupial group, which I think is super cool. There's a marsupial mole, super tiny marsupial mole. And of course, we can't forget the bandicoots and bilbies, which look like rabbits. Though, did you know the Australians celebrate with an Easter bilby, not an Easter rabbit?
Do you know what pulls Santa's sleigh?
Marsupial deer. No, I don't know.
Kangaroos.
Kangaroos pull Santa's sleigh in Australia. Of course they would. But the Easter bilby and other bilbies are insectivorous, which is a cool shift from their placental parallels. Then we've got the possums, phalangers, ringtails, cuscuses, and the diminutive honey possum, or newelbenger, which is the only mammal that eats nectar other than bats. Some members of this group are primate-like, so we've got some primate-like marsupials in addition to all of these other guys, and some of them have even evolved the ability to glide. There's, of course, the arboreal koala, and terrestrial burrowing wombats. They live all over. They live in the trees, in the sky. Well, not in the skies, except for the gliders, and in the ground. And finally, everyone's favorite, the macropodids, the big feet guys. We've got the small omnivorous rat kangaroos, which are also called podaroos. And any Australian, please write in and correct my pronunciation here, because I know it's all wrong. Finally, the larger herbivorous true kangaroos, which include the wallabies and the tree kangaroos, which have left hopping behind for the trees. So that's all the extent, that's sort of the breadth of extant marsupial wildness, which I think is like such a cool, they do it all. They can do it all. The only thing that I couldn't find that living marsupial mammals don't do, that placental mammals do, is live full time in the ocean. I couldn't find any marine marsupials. But if you find any, let me know. Finally, I want to wrap up, which I think will also transition nicely, by mentioning some of the astounding extinct forms, including jerboa-like forms, moles, ferrets, dogs, bears, and even a saber-tooth parallel that we talked about in an earlier episode, lions, and a kangaroo three times the size of today's kangaroos, and finally, a giant rhino-sized wombat that grazed the plains of the Pleistocene savanna in Australia.
Cool. I do know that wombats have cubic droppings.
Their poo is cube.
Which makes me think if the rhino-sized one, like, drops like Rubik's cubes.
Yeah. Bigger than a bread box.
I thought that was really interesting about the amount of the diversity. I think, yeah, I definitely underestimated how many kinds of marsupials there are. I think you might be right that there is that kind of bias, both because I am from Europe, that I am not aware of kind of all the marsupials, but also that in natural history is historically pushed forward by European.
I suppose that would have been an interesting thing to look into, is which evolved first. Because I know there was that discussion around the birds in Australia where they often look quite similar to European ones. Or they'll be from a similar family. So all the presumption was, well, they evolved in Europe and then came to Australia. Because obviously, you know, they evolved in Europe first. But then when they looked at it more closely, they're like, no, they evolved in Australia and then came here. Like, why wouldn't it be that way around? But yeah, the bias was always towards Europe and being the origin of things.
Yeah.
But there's some amazing extinct marsupials, it must be said. I found some cool ones. Perhaps the most famous one is the thylacine, which is also the marsupial which sounds most like a part of, say, your shoulder.
It does. Oh, I sprained my thylacine today.
Yeah. But it's also more commonly known as Tasmanian tiger, which in the long list of things that are badly named, Tasmanian tiger probably join that. Because, in fact, it looks more like a dog. It's a sort of dog-styled marsupial, of which the Tasmanian devil is still around. But to the point where it was so similar that if you showed a skull of a Tasmanian tiger, unless you were really an expert, you'd actually probably find it difficult to say this isn't a dog, this is a marsupial. And they're kind of a fascinating creature because you can see video of them, because as Nick mentioned, they didn't go extinct until the 1930s. And the last living one was in a zoo. So we have film of it, and we have film of it opening its mouth, which is really cool because it could open its mouth really, really far, a bit like a snake almost. The other thing is that they were deliberately hunted to extinction using bounties, which, again, not great on humans' part. But yeah, they would pay people to kill them because they were seen as a pest. So they were literally hunted to extinction in Tasmania. Or at least we think so. This reminds me a bit of, I don't know if you have a similar thing in Ireland, Gnomes, but do you have like phantom big cats that people report in the countryside?
I'm not sure. Now that you're saying it, it's something that I feel like I've vaguely heard of, but it's not something that I'm that aware of.
Well, in England, there's quite a trope of people spotting large wild cats. And you get things like the Beast of Bodmin or the Beast of different areas. And the idea being this is a large cat that's somehow evaded all humans but is occasionally seen. You can Google them and you'll find these sort of like grainy footage of cats, which could just be cats, to be honest. But a lot of people attribute that to, in the 1970s, it was legal to own big cats as pets. And then when they made it illegal, some people just presume they just, let them out. And they've somehow survived in the UK countryside. So there is an element of that where people are reporting they've seen these big things, and then people look at the picture like, that's actually just a kangaroo. But yeah, there's some big people weighed in because it is quite hard to find big cats. Generally, they're very good at avoiding humans. Did you ever hear that story about a cat that escaped from a German zoo? And it wasn't found for weeks. And this was in a major city where zoos tend to be. And it avoided capture in a city and it avoided being seen as well. So this idea that we would automatically find them in a country as large as Australia isn't necessarily true. But there is an element of wishful thinking about it because it is something that human beings would like to find because there's probably quite a lingering guilt. But what's amazing is because of human beings, we also have some amazing records of extinct marsupials. Way up in the north, in a region called Arnhem Land, there's some amazing rock paintings. Now, in this region, the soil is quite unusual in the sense that it's really, really difficult to create fossils, and that these fossils will disappear after about 4,000 years. So the fossil record from this part of Australia is lacking. But what's amazing is there are cave paintings in this region from 44,000 years ago. And these cave paintings are of animals. And they are of animals that we found in fossils in other parts of Australia, which are used to suggest that these used to live here. This includes things like the marsupial lion, which they found, examples of which used to have, I think, the largest saber tooth of any mammal, and a giant kangaroo. So I think the red kangaroo is the largest at the moment.
90 kilos.
He's gone metric. But yeah, they were about twice as large as the largest current living kangaroos by mass. And they were called the short-skulled kangaroos because of their short skulls. Makes sense. And what was interesting is in the cave art, they were very, very distinctive because unlike the modern kangaroos, where their tail tapers to an end, sort of gets thinner, they had thick tails all the way along. So they were really, really distinctive in the cave paintings. And yeah, they were memorialized here. So it shows that their range did go all the way up to the north of Australia. And they were so big, they couldn't hop. They were too big to hop. So you did that big talk about, the bouncy Achilles from kangaroos. They were too big for this. So they would have strided. So even though they had long feet, they were somewhat shorter than modern ones.
Whoa.
That's really cool. I actually saw something that some people, I think it's not very favored, but some people are like, maybe they could have, but it kind of defies everything we know about kind of the physiology of like modern kangaroos. So it's kind of unlikely, but it would be interesting to if they actually could. I think the walking is cool, though. I saw something else that they use their tail in a slightly different way as well. They don't use it in the kind of the like a fifth leg like modern kangaroos do, like Nick told us about.
Fair enough. Well, I can't think how to link having an extra leg to our next topic, which is marsupial reproduction. So I think we just got to plow on with that one. But Naomi, yeah, you wanted to talk about, yeah, marsupial reproduction.
Yeah, so something that I wanted to kind of talk about, because I think it's an interesting way that we can kind of differentiate placental mammals and marsupials is kind of in how they reproduce. So I wanted to talk about this a little bit. And it's interesting because I think it brought up kind of some biases in the way that I was taught about things. So I'll maybe get you guys to weigh in on that part as well and see if the same things happen to you guys. But so the word marsupial comes from marsupium, which is a technical term for the abdominal pouch. It's borrowed from Latin, but it came originally from ancient Greek, which the word means pouch. So there's kind of some interesting things about marsupial reproduction. Most marsupials have a bifurcated penis and a corresponding bifurcated vagina. Macropods have three vaginas and then still the double penis. But something particularly different about them is they, as I mentioned, they don't have a placenta. I'll get into that in a little bit more detail in a second. But marsupial joeys are born very underdeveloped. So they're tiny newborns are born. They crawl up the mother's fur and they latch onto the teeth. So in general, they have very underdeveloped features, except for their forelimbs and their mouth. So this is kind of something that I saw, that they're wondering if this need for their developed forelimbs is kind of limited in some of the ways their forelimbs are able to develop further, which is kind of an interesting idea. Maybe they're kind of limited in what they can, because there's no flippers, there's no hooves, and different things like that. Maybe they're limited because they need these strong forelimbs in order to climb up the mother's fur. And so their gestation period is very short. It's generally about 4 to 5 weeks, and just in comparison to humans, say, which is 40 weeks, but it can be as short as 12 to 14 days. What's interesting about the way I learned this is, so a big difference between marsupials and eutherians, which are placental mammals, is that marsupials don't have placentas. But the thing is, actually, some marsupials do have placentas, number one. They're just not quite as complex. And the way I was taught this is that it's kind of less, they're not as advanced because they don't have this placenta. So the placenta in eutherian mammals allows the mammals to have a longer gestation period, because basically it prevents the mother's immune system targeting the fetus. So they're able to keep the fetus in the womb for longer and able to have more nutrition because they have this kind of complex placenta. So some marsupials do have a placenta. It's made of slightly different tissues and it doesn't have as complex a function. But something I found when I was researching today was that actually people kind of say this, but really maybe the way we should look at it instead is actually there's just a difference in how they deliver these nutrients. So instead of this emphasis on placentation that placental mammals have, marsupials actually instead focus on lactation. So in marsupials, they have different stages of lactation, so they're able to provide different types of milk to different ages of their joeys. And not only that, they can also provide, I think in kangaroos, I'm not sure in other species, but in kangaroos definitely, they're able to provide different milk to two different aged joeys, which I think is very impressive. So one small, like, newborn joey will get a milk that has kind of a certain amount of different fats, proteins, and then the older joey who's more out of the pouch will get a different combination of things as well. So I thought this was something really interesting, and I'm interested to know if you guys had the same sort of biases in how you were taught, that maybe they weren't as developed. And I thought this was a really interesting way of looking at it that this article I found brought up, and then actually it's not so much that they're at a disadvantage because they don't have a placenta, it's just they do it in a different way. They still nurture their young, but they do it through kind of lactation. And because they have a pouch, their newborns are protected in this way. And really actually thinking about it, the lactation and being able to control this, even something that they found in certain studies is that there seems to be overlap in genes in the mammary glands of the marsupials compared to the placenta of eutherian mammals. So it's really quite fascinating. And I think I had given marsupials kind of a hard time, and because I had these biases. I don't know if it's because I learned in kind of in Europe, or if it's because I am a placental mammal, I therefore think we're better. And don't get me wrong, it is a pretty, the placenta is a pretty great organ, but I think I underestimated how impressive marsupials are too.
I think, yeah, for me, it's that notion of, you often hear people say that things are more or less evolved, which is a really weird thought because we're all here, we've all been evolving for almost identical amounts of time. So like, they are equally as evolved as us, just for a different niche. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're going to be really picky, I mean, evolution is probably linked to generational time. So we're much less evolved than flies.
Right.
Yeah, good point.
I definitely learned this way as well, Naomi, where like the sort of marsupials were evolutionarily not as advanced, or like hadn't figured it out the right way. But not only that, but that it was linked to like a competitive advantage. And like, the reason marsupials are not as diverse as placentals is because they didn't have the advantages that the placenta gives to the placental mammals. And I feel like there's a lot to do with biogeography, and there's a lot to do with chance in the distribution and diversity of species on a large scale like that. I think it's way too simplistic to say, because they don't have a placenta, or because they use this mode of reproduction and development, then they're less well suited to, they have a competitive disadvantage, or vice versa. You know, it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I think there maybe are some studies that maybe do look at it in more detail, and perhaps there are some advantages, it could be argued. But yeah, you're definitely right that it's too broad to just kind of this wide brush of that's the only reason that they've done. better.
I had no idea about the milk. That's really interesting that lactation is so much more involved than it is in placental mammals. It makes sense, but it's a cool, like, focus. It resources in a different way.
Absolutely. And I wish I had remembered exactly which order it is. But yeah, basically they're able to control kind of the percentages of protein versus fat versus immunity boosting things. So they give it to different at various different stages, which is cool. And yeah, I didn't realize as well, like I think this was in kangaroos I was looking at, but like the mother like can control the pouch. Like there's muscles there, so she can be like, she can tighten it up if she's like running or hopping, and she can kind of loosen it out if the joey's getting in and out, which is just, it's cool.
I don't know for sure, but I bet you that that's somehow connected to what we talked about last week, the epipubic bones, which are, they're actually not distinctive of the marsupials. The only mammals that don't have the epipubic bones as a group are the placentals. The monotremes and the marsupials both have epipubic bones, and the stem mammals do as well. And the epipubic bones, basically, if you're standing up like a kangaroo, then they come they come forward and upwards from the pelvis, right where the pouch is, and they're sort of like supports for the pouch. So I wonder if the tightening muscles that can like change the pouch elasticity are connected to the epipubic bones. I have to assume that they would be.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
I wanted to talk about opossums a bit.
Oh, I think I'll let you.
Thanks. Just it's connected in some ways to this, but I don't know. There's a group that I knew almost nothing about, to the point where if someone was like, what's the difference between an opossum and a possum? I would tell you one of them lives in North America and the other doesn't. That's about what I could have done a week ago, just to give you a sense of the bias that I, as a mammal, literal mammal biologist, like that's as far as I could go. And so now I know, and I'll go through it for you guys. It's actually quite cool. Opossums are a cool group. They're in the family Didelphidae, which is such a, first of all, a beautiful name. And possums are not actually one monophyletic taxonomic group, but a sort of handful of members of different marsupial families in the Australidelphiae that we talked about earlier. So the Didelphidae include somewhere between 75 and 100 species, like I said earlier, and they're mostly in the Americas. They're small to medium, and they almost all of them, but not all of them, have long, scaly, prehensile tails. And the classic example and the largest opossum is the North American opossum, Didelphis virginiana. I'll say that with less of an American accent. Didelphis virginiana, which is the one that sort of looks like...
Which accent did you think the second one was?
Well, I said virginiana the first time, which is a little too much for even me. Okay, but a little bit more about morphology of the opossums. They have large, clawless, and opposable toes, which I thought was a pretty cool thing that you didn't know about opossums. But it makes sense. They do a lot of climbing. They're arboreal. And some genera, this is, goes back to what we were talking about with reproduction, have the distinct marsupial pouch. But that's only three genera. And the rest of them either have a reduced pouch or just a fold of skin. And the fold basically protects the babies. I don't know if you call them joeys. No, that's just kangaroos. It protects the young when they're still very small, but it's not a full pouch. They have 50 teeth. Sounds like a nightmare, but they're quite small. And they're mainly omnivorous. They're not human hunters, so no problem there. But some are exclusively insectivorous. They're mostly active in the evening. I feel like this is like a dating profile for opossums, which I'm happy to provide. So they're mostly active in the evening and at night, and most live on the ground or in trees. One genus is semi-aquatic, not marine though, so don't worry. Now, Naomi, you mentioned this earlier, and I really want to call attention to this. One of the opossums has a gestation period of 12 and a half to 13 days, which is less than 2 weeks, which means that from conception to birth, it's less than 2 weeks, a fortnight, if you will. And you'd think, oh, it's probably one of the small mouse-like opossums. Wrong. It's the biggest one. It's the North American opossum. 14 days for that baby to pop out of litter. That's crazy. I thought that was pretty wild. It's the shortest of any mammal that we know of today. And those specifically, when they're born, they have claws. They're born with claws that helps them climb to the pouch. And once they get to the pouch, the claws fall off. They're deciduous claws. Cool. And their nasal passage is separate from their esophagus, unlike in most mammals, so that they can breathe and swallow at the same time. Because essentially, from when they attach to the nipple in the pouch until they've grown, they're like on a constant milk drip. They're just like constantly drinking. So they like have to breathe and do the drinking at the same time. But their body has adapted to do that. Pretty cool. Weirdly, they have no body temperature regulation at this stage in their development. They're entirely reliant on the mother's body heat. Also, in addition to that, you think, what's the atmosphere like in the pouch? It must be pretty warm. It's, you know, there's the milk coming from the, there's a milk source. But apparently it's pretty sealed. Because the carbon dioxide levels with the air that they breathe in and out over the course of their development reaches levels 8 to 20 times higher than the atmosphere outside the pouch, and they can survive it with no problem. And it's not clear to researchers whether this does something developmentally that helps the opossums as they grow, or if it's just an unusually high tolerance to high carbon dioxide levels. But either way, the opossums are doing cool things.
But it smells in there.
It probably smells like a warm opossum pouch.
Yeah.
Whatever that may be.
With a constant milk drip.
With a constant milk drip. And even after they're born, they'll still cling to the mom for a while. Sometimes you can see the mom like climbing on the underside of a branch with the babies on her stomach, or vice versa, crawling along the side of the road with her babies on her back. That's for most opossums. But the last thing I wanted to say about the opossums is that they're very cute. Even including the North American opossum, Xydelphus virginiana, which is giant, kind of like a trash rat, but also cute. So next time you see, next time someone asks you, what's the difference between an opossum and a possum? You'll be able to tell them a lot about opossums, but not a lot about possums. Sorry, that's another.
Actually, something that you reminded me of when you were talking about whether the pouch was smelly or not, something that I read about what the mother does. So the babies don't defecate inside the pouch. They actually don't defecate until the mother is like grooming them, and she actually like removes the feces with her tongue. So kind of gross, but also bearing in mind it is a baby that's only drinking newborn milk, so it's probably not as gross as it could be. But yeah. And she also then cleans out the pouch as well. So, you know, probably clean, maybe a bit smelly, but maybe just like, you know, must.
I mean, if you ever have children, if you think back to that sentence, you're like, well, it won't be as gross because it's only eating milk.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
One of the sort of strange urban legends that I read about, well, there's a lot of urban legends about marsupials, but I guess that goes back to the bias that we're talking about. But one of them was that marsupials, the opossums in particular, are they conceive and also give birth through their nasal cavities, was one of the urban legends. And the reason for this was that it's often observed that opossums will like root around and sniff in their pouch, and then soon after, babies appear in the pouch. And there's no connection, of course, between the vagina and the birth canal and the pouch. So the sort of question was, well, then how does the baby get there? And like seeing the tiny baby crawl to the pouch just happens so fast that it's not something that you usually catch. But what the mother's doing is cleaning out the pouch in preparation for the baby's arrival. But I thought that was a funny urban legend. Not urban even at all. Funny old wives tale. No, don't throw the old wives under the bus. A funny misconception about marsupials.
Very true. And on that, I feel that's brought us to an end on our topic all about marsupials. We'll be back next week, listeners, because we'll be talking about shells, which could be quite an interesting topic. Till next week, from everyone here at the Natural Selection Presents, it's goodbye.
Goodbye, Val.
Bye. We'll be right back.
today. I must say, that, if anything, that sounds Irish.
Do I?
What's it called?
The Virginia opossum?